2 of that 590 show coming at you live right now on 590 The Fan, 105.7 HD2 FM and InsideSTL.com. Matt Berger, Matt Rocchio alongside Pablo Giamatti, a.k.a. John Rudolph, with a hard part sporting tonight and a collared shirt. He's got a hot date later. He's behind the dials. Joining us right now on the Bellman Automotive phone line is the longtime NFL journalist. You can follow him on Twitter at HBalzer721. Read him at BalzerFootball.com. And, of course, hear him on the Hall of Fame show on the NFL channel on SiriusXM. Howard, how are you?
Doing great, Matthews. How are you guys doing?
Doing fantastic, sir. It looked like it was another fun weekend in Canton, minus the tornado warning that was there on Friday night. But it sounds like overall, though, a very successful Hall of Fame induction ceremony.
You know, it was really wild is that I wasn't even aware of the tornado warnings. It's really strange. I mean, I was, you know, Friday they had press conferences, and then there was a couple hours in between the press conferences and the Gold Jacket dinner, and so I went back and you know just rested for a very brief time and got ready for the dinner, and it was raining and all that, but all of a sudden I find out, and then I headed over for the Gold Jacket dinner, so I wasn't even aware that there were tornado warnings or even when they were, and I heard about it afterwards.
I saw a few people who were from the West Coast, you know, they're covering because of LaDainian Tomlinson being inducted from the San Diego Chargers. And they're like, yeah, I mean, there's no such thing as tornadoes out there on the West Coast. They're like, I have no idea what to do. I'm hearing a siren and I'm freaking out.
Yeah. So, and I'll tell you, you know, the temperature had been almost what it has been in St. Louis. It wasn't quite that bad, but it was, you know, in the high 80s or low 90s there and a little bit of a humidity, not bad. And I'll tell you, that storm came in. And when we came out of the dinner on Friday, which was, you know, about 9 or 9:15 Eastern time, it was down, and I said, oh, my goodness. It was like 64 degrees. That's how much the storm that came in lowered the temperature. So, and it turned out on Saturday to be, you know, a very very pleasant day and evening when a lot of times it's pretty darn hot.
So who do you think gave the best speech on Saturday night? I know that Jason Taylor gave a pretty good one. LaDainian Tomlinson, there are people talking about now that LaDainian Tomlinson may run for public office. That's how much they loved his speech. I thought that Kurt Warner's was good, but I thought it was going to be a little more memorable. I guess you could say is a better word for it than what it was. To me, the biggest takeaway from the Warner's was Brenda Warner's hair. I don't know too many women that are walking into the salon and going, "Give me the Brenda Warner." She looked like she was like a you know, the lead singer of a punk band, or she like, or the, you know, actually I said that she looked like she'd be someone who would be outside protesting the NFL.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I'll get to the hair in a moment, and I'll answer your first question, your first question first, and I definitely thought it was Tomlinson. I thought there were a lot of good ones. You're right on Jason Taylor. I thought Jerry Jones was pretty good. I thought all of them, you know, were pretty good, and they all had, you know, certain messages that they wanted to, you know, put out there. And so Terrell Davis I thought was good. But Tomlinson, I thought it was a combination of the message and his way of doing it. I just thought as a speaker, he was the best speaker, and the way it turned out. I thought Kurt would be I got the impression Kurt was a little nervous. He seemed to be not as, I don't know what the word, kind of open, kind of calm that he normally is when he speaks and all that. I don't know if it's because he had to wait so darn long to give the speech or what, but I think he did warm up throughout it, and it was still, you know, it was still a good speech. So, yeah. But I definitely thought Tomlinson was the best. In terms of Brenda, I saw her, you know, Kurt, you know, all the enshrinees have parties. And in the past, they used to always be after the enshrinement. And they'd set up tents on the grounds of the Hall of Fame. And then it was easy, you know, because you never know what time the thing is going to end. But the earliest usually it ever ends is 11 o'clock Eastern time. And so they'd have these tents in different places, and all pretty close. And so, like, the Hall of Famers, the returning Hall of Famers liked it because they could go from one party to the next and just go from one tent to the other. And it was convenient because no one had to leave the Hall of Fame after the ceremony and go somewhere else. Well, it started changing a couple of years ago where the Enshrining started moving their parties off campus, if you will. And so even, you know, in Orlando Pace last year had his on Saturday after the Enshrinement. Terrell Davis this year, and I don't know when all of them were because I ended up going to three, but Terrell Davis had his after the Enshrinement, but it was also off-site. And I didn't even get there. And there were buses arriving the same time as I did till 12:30
Wow.
Eastern time. And so you know, Kurt Warner had his party on Thursday, which was the earliest I'd ever experienced a party. It was actually a pretty good move in some respects because the game was Thursday, and who really cares about the game? And so I went to the game for the first half and then left and went to Kurt's party. And the first thing you notice when you walk in was when you saw Brenda, you go, oh, my goodness. What is that all about? And your initial – and I'll tell you guys, I had – not only media saying it to me at many different times, but I had some Hall of Famers, you know, who knew I was from St. Louis, say, "What is it with Brenda's hair?" And I said, "You can't explain it, but all I said is, and I think it's fairly evident, and we've all known this ever since, you know, 99, is that Brenda believes she's part of the show." And she, you know, how many times do we hear her when she would give an interview and she was doing a little radio bit? I forget which station was on, one of the FM stations, where one time they were upset about something that happened. And said, "We're upset, you know, by this. You know, we're upset, not Kurt's upset. You know, by some of the stuff that was going on with March and the thumb. Remember that? And the
yeah, controversy absolutely.
Over that, it was always we, as if she was part of his excellence and part of his career. And so I said, this almost takes the cake because it's as if I don't want all the attention going to Kurt. I want people to look at me. And I don't know. It was just strange. And then to hear Kurt, it's like sometimes he's oblivious to what others think, and maybe he's not oblivious and he doesn't care. But when he even brought it up during the speech and said, "Hey," and talking about her, which is fine, talk about his wife, you know, they all do that for the most part, but then say, "Hey, and how about her hair? That's the coolest hair there is," whatever his line was. And I'm saying, seriously? You really think that? And that was appropriate for a Hall of Fame celebration? I'll tell you one other quick story. And maybe you guys saw it at the Gold Jacket dinner. And I know it was televised, so I assume that this was on TV, that when all the Hall of Famers come on to get their gold jacket, they come on one by one, and David Baker of the Hall of Fame is on the stage, Roger Goodell is on the stage holding the gold jacket, and the presenter is on the stage to take off the jacket that they are wearing, and then Goodell hands them the gold jacket, and they put it on the Hall of Famer. And that's the first time they've got that on. And so, remember now, Kurt was the last person introduced at the dinner as well. At the dinner, they did it all by, you know, they mix it up for the speeches, but at the dinner, they do it in alphabetical order. And so Kurt was the last one. And he walks on the stage, obviously. Well, they're all on the stage. And Brenda does her thing, puts the gold jacket on him, and every other of the previous six Hall of Famers, as soon as the presenter was done putting the jacket on, they left the stage. And the Hall of Famer, you know, accepted the accolades, you know, walked around the stage for about a minute or two.
Yeah.
Waving to each section and just waving and as everybody's cheering them. So Kurt gets up there and Brenda takes the gold jacket off and she stays on the stage. She doesn't leave. And then Kurt grabs her hand. And they're holding hands.
And walking around the stage
around
together.
The stage, waving to the crowd.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there going, you've got to be kidding me. And then I was wondering what would happen next, because as soon as the last Hall of Famer goes up there, all of the other ones come on stage to get you know, that last applause of all of them on the stage wearing their gold jacket. Well, here's everyone coming on the stage, and Brenda's still out there, dodging this guy and dodging that guy. And finally, it hit her, maybe I should leave.
Yeah. Maybe I should let these guys have their moment.
Yeah, exactly. So she did at least leave the stage at that point. But I don't know. I was just flummoxed by it all. But like I said, it's no surprise, you know, given what we've experienced and knowing the way it is. Now, here's one other thing. Thursday night at the party, about an hour in, maybe, I don't know, an hour and a half in or whatever, Brenda goes up on stage at the party where they had a band playing. And they're trying to get everybody quiet, and people are tinkling glasses, and you know, there's a lot of talking in the room. And so as she's talking and no one can hear, and she starts saying, hey, you know what? Pretty soon I'm going to have to, like, call upon my military background and get some order in here.
Yeah, because she used to be a Marine.
Yeah, exactly. Well, then one of the guys in the band just let out a piercing whistle, and everybody got quiet. So she gets up there, and she says this: when I was asked to be the presenter, I thought I was going to be able to go on stage at the enshrinement and give a speech. That's the way it used to be. I don't remember how long ago it changed. I want to say at least maybe 10 years.
Wasn't it the time when Junior Seau was supposed to be inducted in and his daughter was going to introduce him? This was after he had passed.
No, this was before that. It didn't have anything to do with Junior Seau's thing and that whole situation where there was some confusion on her part, where she thought she was going to get to give a speech.
But wasn't it around that time when they decided to do away with that, or am I wrong?
It was years before that.
Okay.
Like I said, I don't remember when, but they've been doing that for quite a while. And the reason they started doing it was because some of the presenters were going longer than the enshrinees. And they were given like these 15, 20-minute speeches. And so it was making an already long ceremony even longer. So that's when the Hall of Fame came up with the idea that the presenter will be interviewed prior. They'll edit it down to a 3-minute bit, play it on the big screen, and play it in the broadcast. And then, but the presenter will be there on stage with the Hall of Famer and unveil the bust. So Brenda gets up there and says that I thought I was going to get to give a speech. So when I found out I didn't, I wasn't going to do that, and they had, you know, this edited thing. She said, "Well, I wanted to be able, so I'm gonna give the speech now that I would have given if I was allowed to." And she went on for about 15 minutes. And it's, but it was, what can I say? It's Brenda being Brenda, and that's just the way it is.
H, taking a look at the Hall of Fame, the way that the game has changed over the years is obviously going to change the way you guys look at things. The sack rate and the interception rate in the NFL are dropping to historical all-time lows. You have guys like Matthew Stafford who are putting up numbers to the point where they're on pace to break Peyton Manning's yardage record and things like that. So I'm just wondering, has there been a discussion already in the room about how voting and looking at defensive players and skill position players is going to have to change now and in the future? Is that already a conversation going on?
Well, I mean, the conversation is going on. We don't talk about it as much in the room because it takes enough time just talking about all the individual players. But that conversation does go on, whether it's between us at games or at different places or just generally. And because, hey, we've dealt with it for the last decade with log jams at receivers and the crazy numbers that the receivers put up. We've dealt with it even, you know, you mentioned the interception rates are down, mm-hmm. but there's still a lot of guys getting a lot of sacks. And so, you know, we've had a lot of pass rushers with a lot of sacks going in, you know, in the last 10 years. So I think that revelation, if you will, has already been there in terms of how, and I've said it many times, I've asked some different players. I've asked Andre Reed, for example. Got to know him pretty decent. He always comes on when we tape our shows there for Sirius and in the days before the enshrinement. I said, and you went through it, and I know it was probably pretty difficult, but I'm sure you, to a degree, you probably understood that there's so the numbers are just so crazy. I said, how do we differentiate between these guys that where the numbers are so crazy? And we had Terrell Owens and Isaac Bruce as a finalist last year, and they're huge numbers. Randy Moss comes in, or will be in the mix as a first-time eligible this year. Andre Johnson retired this past season. 5 years, he'll be on the list, and he's got over 1,000 receptions. Reggie Wayne, look at a guy like Reggie Wayne.
Yeah,
I think of Reggie Wayne as a heck of a player. I don't know if he's a Hall of Famer, but you look at his numbers and you go, oh my goodness. And certainly a lot of it was because he was on a team with Peyton Manning all those years and Marvin Harrison, and they threw the ball a tremendous amount. And so he put up, big numbers. And it's only going to continue to be that way. And it's up to the committee to try to figure it all out and say, okay, who are truly Hall of Famers? And it's not easy. It's not easy. I just mentioned those guys. I didn't mention Torrey Holt, who's right in there in the conversation with Isaac as well. So it's just going to continue, and it never really gets settled, but you just have to deal with it.
Obviously, it's going to be very complicated, and it'll happen gradually, but is essentially just going to be a change in how you view the benchmarks? Like, for example, right now, there are 10 players in the NFL right now who are averaging more yards per game receiving than Jerry Rice did across his career. So, obviously, the fact that hard numbers aren't going to be a useful comparison anymore, but then again, the NFL in the Hall of Fame specifically has been dealing with this moving benchmarks thing for the last, 30, 40 years. So, I wonder, obviously, again, it's not going to be simple, but do you think it's just going to be one of those things where we'll see players who maybe get these huge numbers, like the 10,000 yard receiving, who just never get in because of the way the benchmarks finally shift?
I guess it's possible. I don't know if it'll be that they'll never get in, but I think what it'll eventually come down to is that you can't compare players, obviously, to players from 15, 20 years ago. I think, in a sense, you have to look at it when groups of players retire and look at the group that they were in and the time that they played and who dominated within that time. And that ends up becoming, I think, probably maybe the best way to compare it. Many times, they have all-decade teams. And obviously on an all-decade team, you can only have a couple receivers. Now that doesn't mean, I think there's only two of them, maybe there's three, I'm not even sure. But it doesn't mean that the fourth receiver, if there's three or the third receiver, two, are bad players. But the guys who are voted all decade are certainly the ones you're going to look at and say, okay, that's probably a Hall of Famer. Then it becomes the other ones that are still right there also, what happens with them? All decade is tough though, because you have a guy like Isaac Bruce who spanned two decades, essentially from 95 to 2005. He played more years in there, of course, but those were his best years. And so he didn't play in one regular decade. And so that shouldn't be the benchmark, but it ends up being a certain comparison point. But like I said, I think it comes down to, who dominated, who were the standouts within their group in that period of time. And that's what ends up being what separates, what hopefully is able to separate guys.
Howard Balzer joining us right now on the Bellman Automotive phone line. You can follow him on Twitter at HBalzer721. He was in Canton over the weekend for the Hall of Fame ceremony. Very disappointed in you, Howard, for not throwing anything at Jerry Jones while he was giving his speech, but we'll move on. While there, during the whole weekend, you have LaDainian Tomlinson being enshrined. He's known for being a San Diego Charger, even though he was with the New York Jets for like a season. But he's known for being a San Diego Charger, and that franchise no longer exists. Kurt Warner, famous for being a member of the St. Louis Rams and the greatest show on turf. I know he took the Arizona Cardinals to their only Super Bowl, and he has some really great years with them. But he's mostly known for being a St. Louis Ram, another franchise that doesn't exist. Did anybody kind of like walk around that weekend going, you know what, we're enshrining people who are members of teams that no longer exist? Why is that? I mean, like, could we maybe have done more to keep these cities or keep these teams in these cities? And Ward Cleaver is texting in wanting to know what kind of role Kenny Ratcliffe played in the Rams leaving.
Well, I'll just say, well, first of all, I mean, those franchises exist. They're just in different cities. And but I understand what you're saying. And, you know, LaDainian Tomlinson, in a lot of talks when he was asked about it, would say, I will be the last San Diego Charger, at least from the standpoint of playing only for the San Diego Chargers, and even though he went to the Jets, like you said, to go into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
If Antonio Gates goes in or Philip Rivers goes in, well, they will be finishing their careers as Los Angeles Chargers. But they're still Chargers. And so, but no one was going around saying that. You know, I thought it was cool that, you know, Chris Berman, when he was, you know, in the beginning of the night when he was talking about Kurt Warner, he emphasized St. Louis and St. Louis Rams. So that was nice to hear. It doesn't change anything, obviously, in what happened. But I think for the most part, yeah, there's people say, hey, this stuff shouldn't happen. It's too bad. But for the most part, everybody moves on.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's the way it is. I did have a conversation with Roger Goodell.
Did you?
On Friday. Now, first I'll say Thursday, one of the first people I saw walking into Kurt Warner's party were Stan Kroenke and Kevin Demoff. Were both there at the party. And I was struck by the fact that neither of them were in Canton last year for Orlando Pace. So I'm thinking to myself, I wanted so much to go up to them and say, hey, nice to show up for the Rams player this year because Jerry Jones is going.
Yeah, that's why they're there.
You know, exactly. But I didn't do that. But I didn't go and say hello to him. I felt like even standing even within 10 yards of them, I felt I needed to go home and take a shower. But it's just that. But anyway, there was one period at the party. Goodell was there too at the party. And it wasn't just a token appearance. He was there for a good two and a half hours.
Oh, wow.
Hanging out, talking to people. But there was one 45-minute to an hour stretch where at the back of the room, he and Kroenke were just standing there talking. And I'm thinking to myself, boy, would I like to be a fly on that.
Yeah,
ball,
no kidding.
You know, to hear that conversation. So I did say hello to him there at the party, but it was loud and it was hard to communicate. The next day, they have the Board of Trustees luncheon that the selectors that are in town are invited to. And so I was there, and Goodell's always there, and he comes over to the selectors and says hello, and he's talking to different guys about this and doing about that, and it's very casual and informal. And then some guys went, then it kind of split up, and then he was standing somewhat alone. I went up to him and just started talking a little bit about this and that. And he said, how's things or whatever. I said, well, man, I'm just, you know, it's tough to be in St. Louis. You know, it's tough to be in St. Louis. And he just looked at me. He didn't say anything. And I said, you know, it's very difficult for the people there who just feel, and myself included, what an unfair process it was, and that there was just a feeling of dirtiness to it. I said that. And he said, well, I don't know about it. I said, well, you know, here's the thing, Roger. I said, the league approved this relocation, and St. Louis was slammed on the way out by the Rams. And I said that I think it's pretty, and the stadium plan was slammed when this was put together in about a year without any contribution from the home team, from the Rams. You know, it was negotiating with the league. It was, you know, there. Yes, there were hurdles, and there was, you know, this or that wasn't the greatest about the plan, but they raised the public money they said they were going to raise.
Yeah, considering how quickly it was put together.
Yeah, and that was all done, you know, without the team saying, well, we can do this or we can do that.
Yeah.
It was silence. And that's just, that was just unfair. So he said, well, I understand the way you feel. He says, and I can say that there was probably some blame to be had on both sides.
Oh, well.
Now,
way to sit on that fence there, Roger.
I didn't pursue it because I wanted to say, well, what blame on St. Louis's side? But I didn't pursue it from that point. But at least to hear him even say that
Yeah.
was you know, what was, you know, a good thing. I said the real disappointing thing is if this was going to be a pure business decision, which it obviously was, and that this whole, you know, project around the stadium and everything was something the league wanted, and it was a fait accompli that it was going to be San Kroenke and the Rams, that something should have been done, like when Cleveland left, when the Browns left to go to Baltimore.
We should be given some kind of assurance that we will get a franchise. I'm with you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Back to Ward Cleaver's question. What kind of contribution or lack of contribution do you think Kitty Ratcliffe had to the Rams leaving St. Louis?
I don't think she had much at all. I mean, she didn't sign she didn't tell Stan Kroenke to do what she did, and certainly the Leafs certainly set the stage for him leaving, but that was Tom Eagleton and those who negotiated that lease never anticipating that there was going to be whatever it was, 20 to 23 newer renovated stadiums in the next 15 to 20 years. But when it came down to negotiating on the first tier clause, it made no economic sense that no city would have done what St. Louis would have had to do to spend $700 million to renovate a stadium, that there was no guarantee that the team would be there after the next 10 years.
Yeah.
Because the Rams absolutely refused to enter negotiations to extend the lease.
And I don't think there's any way they're going to be able to renovate that dome and have the team still play there at the same time, too. So I have no idea if they were going to play at Busch Stadium. Was that even going to work? So, I mean, that was doomed from the very beginning.
Well, sure. Well, you know, they could have gotten around it for the 2 years, whatever it was. I mean, the Chicago Bears played in Champaign a couple of years while their stadium
That's true.
Was being renovated. So you could have come up with a temporary solution. I mean, what the heck? The Chargers are playing in a 30,000-seat stadium. Until the stadium's ready out there. So you could have come up with a solution. But the economics of it, you know, I've heard people say, even in St. Louis, oh, well, you know, you wouldn't spend $700 million, but then you propose a $1.1 billion stadium. Well, yeah, but St. Louis would have been responsible for all of the $700 million.
Yeah, that $1 billion was, you know, some from the NFL, some from the owner, and some from the state, and some from the city.
Exactly, and then in the renovation, it was all St. Louis.
Yeah,
and you know, St. Louis, we talk St. Louis as this entity, but they tried to argue that the average team contribution to all of the new and renovated stadiums that there have been in the NFL since that expansion back in 1995, 52% was the average team contribution. Well, if St. Louis had renovated for $700 million, there was zero team contribution. And granted, that's the way the lease was written.
Yeah.
But if you had an owner who truly wanted to stay in St. Louis and wanted to work with St. Louis, they would have come up with ideas or plans or a way to make whatever it was work. But we all know that was not in the cards. So that's the way it was. So I said that to Goodell about, you know, St. Louis being, you know, there should have been more of an effort to replace a team in an excellent football market, and he didn't really say anything to that, but at least I put it out there for him to hear.
Well, like you said, maybe when they try to settle this lawsuit, maybe they can just kind of throw that in there. Oh, by the way, we want a franchise too. Howard Balzer.
Yeah, that's the way we'll settle it.
Yeah, Howard Balzer, thank you for your time this evening, sir. Sounds like you had a wonderful weekend in Canton. I hope the next time I see you, you do not have Brenda Warner's haircut, but if you did, I would understand.
I definitely will not, although I'll tell you, I was on the air earlier today filling in for Frank, and it looked to me like Brendan Schaefer there. I don't know if you've seen him. He's sporting a haircut that's getting close to Brenda.
Is it?
And he's got to be careful.
I'll let him know. I haven't seen Brendan Schaefer in a while. He was on right before you, but I haven't seen him in a while. So,
oh yeah, Howard's on top of that one. And he's it's definitely Mohawkish. He doesn't have the body in the hair that Brenda's rolling with, but he could get there. It's dangerous.
Well,
you're right about that one.
We will
warn him.
Howard, your boy Rocchio here is getting kind of shaggy too. He's kind of got like this Roger Federer kind of look going on. You may not have talked with him too.
Yeah, they've been giving me a lot of crap, Howard. I wear headbands now. Yeah, it's crazy.
Howard, thank you for your time, sir. We look forward to talking to you next week.
All right, guys. Take care.
That is Howard Balzer from BalzerFootball.com and the Hall of Fame show on NFL Channel on SiriusXM. You can follow him on Twitter at HBalzer721. The only thing hotter than the weather are the deals going down at Bellman Automotive in Troy, Missouri. Summer may be coming to an end, but the sales continue to roll on. Thinking about one last family road trip before the kids head back to school? Contact Ryan Kemner and his great sales staff at Bellman Automotive today and get an upgrade on that SUV or minivan. Have a son or daughter on their way back to college and want to make sure they have a dependable car that won't leave them stranded? Contact Bellman Automotive today and check out their great inventory of used vehicles. In fact, with any new or used vehicle purchase, you will have your choice of a new TV, KT cooler, or gun. Not only do they have a top-notch service department, but financing for everyone to accommodate all customers. You really can't go wrong with Bellman Automotive, 175 Turnbell Trail in Troy, Missouri. Give them a call at 636-462-3600, BellmanCDJR.com. We'll take a commercial break. You're listening to That 590 Show right here on 590 The Fan, 105.7 HD2 FM at InsideSTL.com.